Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Good evening, Diane. How are you?
I am well. How are you?
I'm doing fine.
Yeah? Finally got some cooler weather?
A little bit, yeah.
Got some rain?
We have a little moisture. That's always a good thing.
I know most of the country's still kind of sweltering, but we're in that rare and fortunate place at the south end of the Great Lakes, getting some of that cool Canadian air.
Yeah, nice for a change.
Yeah, I think it's going to heat back up.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, right.
Of course.
Okay, I guess we have to do it. Ready?
Well,
Olympics, as you said. Let's talk about the Olympics. So what do you got for us from the Olympics, from your perspective?
Not watching a lot of television because there isn't anything else on but the Olympics. Nobody's programming against the Olympics. So if you're not watching the Olympics, you're not watching television. I saw my shadow this week, so I think that means that there's 6 more weeks of Olympic coverage.
No.
That's all I know.
No, not
6 more weeks?
I don't think so.
It'll only seem that way?
Look how fast the tour faded.
True.
We are going to discuss this. You and I are both a little shocked by it, but there was an unfortunate incident, actually a race director's worst nightmare at the Mentor Headlands Triathlon last week.
The Greater Cleveland Tri. Out in Mentor.
So I guess the lake just was choppy and nasty, and this was a fairly inexperienced swimmer, got into trouble in the water, and had to be helped. I mean, they got him to shore. He did not have a pulse. Several athletes administered CPR.
Yep.
And while they were waiting for the EMS, which they came very quickly, I guess.
The race organizers had a defibrillator, which they had there.
That's right.
Immediately. And then they have, of course, paramedics from Mentor Fire standing by right there. On the beach.
And we understand he is still in the hospital. He is in very, very critical condition. My sympathies go out to everybody concerned, family, friends, and certainly all the people at the races who helped. And you know what was really, really heartening is that people did help, you know, that they didn't back away from, you know, what was going on. So,
yeah, there is, it sort of points up that there is always an element of risk in these activities that we do, and, you know, we like to sort of push those out of our mind, because if we thought about them too much,
we wouldn't do anything.
We'd sit at home on our couches, which is risky.
Yeah, that's in a whole different way.
Yeah. So, do be careful out there. And I would say sometimes you have to take a look at the conditions and decide whether the better part of valor is staying on the shore or whether you want to jump in and, mix it up with Mother Nature. You know, it's a judgment call that everybody has to make, nearly every time we go out.
Well, when I was directing the old triathlon back in the 80s, we had a very comprehensive pre-event brochure that we sent out. And we were very clear about how to train for swimming.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if it's training in a pool is not the same as training in open water.
Sure.
And you have to get into the open water and train a lot
mm-hmm.
if you're going to be confident. And then when you get a rough lake, and Lake Erie can be pretty nasty.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I hope the outcome is okay, but we don't know at this time. Anyway, so this is only tangential reference to cycling and bicycles. But how cool would it be to have something you made end up on Mars?
Yeah.
Lightspeed, the titanium manufacturer in Chattanooga, did that. The company welded parts of the frame of the Mars rover at the Chattanooga factory under contract with the Jet Propulsion Lab. And besides the tubular frame, the rover also has a titanium, now I don't know what this is, rocker bogey suspension?
Suspension, yeah.
Yeah, of some sort. But how cool is that?
Yeah. Engineers at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory report that Curiosity's frame is both laterally stiff and vertically compliant.
Well, there you have it.
And
a custom titanium frame.
Grant Peterson of Rivendell was heard to be worried about the lack of anyone skilled in welding titanium within 140,000 miles of the Gale crater. So, you know, if it breaks down.
It breaks down. you know what? Those welds are going to hold. They're just fine.
I know. But they always say, you know, if you're riding a steel bike, you can get that fixed anywhere. But,
yeah, right.
Know, yeah,
oh, up on Mars. Yes. By the way, I'll send Lincoln Electric up to weld it. What do you think?
Sure.
They're right in town here.
Sure. Well,
yeah.
Lincoln could weld your tie frame if you needed it.
Well, that's true. Lincoln did weld our track.
But that's right. They
yeah,
did.
They did.
Anyway, so.
Well, Peter Hurley, who's the CEO of Lightspeed's parent company, American Bicycle Group, said, "It's been truly inspirational to have played a part in a project of such importance to our nation's space program. I'm exceedingly proud of my team, both for their daily commitment to engineering and building the best bikes in the world, and also for their willingness and enthusiasm to accept challenges of this magnitude." No kidding.
Yeah.
Good for them. Good
did you
for them.
See the landing? Did you stay up?
I did not.
I did.
I saw the 3 millionth time that they replayed it. You know, they replayed it a gazillion times.
Yeah, I saw the whole thing live. It was very inspirational, and it was fun to know that we're all getting this information, even the JPL people, 14 minutes after it really happened on Mars, because it takes that long for all this stuff
for the transmission to come down.
So, you know, it's really already happened, but it's unfolding in real time, 14 minutes behind Mars time. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was a great engineering feat, great science and engineering feat.
So I have another little piece that I'd like to talk about. It appeared online this week. Remember, I talked at press camp with Carlton Reed. He's Mr. Roads Were Not Built for Cars.
Oh, yeah.
And he is the editor of Bike Biz, which is the UK equivalent of Brain, Bicycle Retailer and Industry News.
Okay.
This I thought was very interesting. The piece is titled Comment, There's No Such Thing as a Free Lunch. And it's funny. It's subtitled, Carlton Reed Gets His Cones Adjusted. 2 minutes later and $14 later, he's a happy bunny. Why? Now, there's a little bit of Britishisms in here that I don't exactly understand. But anyway, this is when we were at press camp. I didn't know this had happened. Last month, I was in Utah for press camp and needed to get a borrowed Cannondale EVO fettled before a two-day sportive out in the boondocks. Now, I don't know what fettled means, but I guess fixed up.
Yeah, you've never heard the expression, I'm in fine fettle, meaning I'm in great condition?
I guess not.
Yeah, okay.
All righty then. The sportive's tech support wouldn't carry a full line of tools, and I needed a Chris King cone tool. I'd been lucky enough to bag the use of some Envy carbon clinchers, but they wobbled, and I didn't fancy riding 175 miles on wheels that would only get wobblier, and certainly didn't want to damage such premium bits of kit. I was traveling with a Utah resident, and he knew a bike shop which would probably have the right tools for the job. We decided to pay a visit to Contender of Salt Lake City, which is an excellent bike shop. They've been around, and they know their stuff. They know their stuff.
Careful.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm trying. Contender's mechanics took the Evo from me, adjusted the cones in a matter of minutes. The mechanic charged me $14. My friend was surprised. I was happy to pay this. He said, but it only took a few seconds. It would be no skin off their nose to do that sort of job for free. I was happy because the shop was charging for the use of special tools and the time of a specialist member of their staff. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a lot to be said for doing some jobs as freebies for the goodwill engendered. A bike purchase may be made next visit by a customer made happy by such largesse. But where do you draw the line? Does a car garage do these simple jobs for free in the hope a car purchase may come from it? Absolutely not. Contender's still receipt carried a menu item for cone adjustment. Time is money. Expertise is valuable. Many bike shops give away what ought to be charged for, and too many customers expect bike shops to do quote-unquote simple mechanical tasks for free. Mm-hmm. Some bike shops and many customers need to wake up and smell the coffee. So Carlton Reed, thank you, thank you, thank you. It was an excellent piece, and I am so happy to know that you feel that way, because I certainly feel that way. And I understand.
You've heard the anecdote about the person who was outraged at getting the $500 bill from the engineer who turned the adjustment screw a quarter of a turn.
Or who put the X on the,
And he says, you know, break that down. He says, well, it was $1 to turn the screw and $499 to know which one to turn and which direction.
Exactly. Yeah. I have a very similar story about a guy who puts the X where the problem is.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess we should move on, maybe.
Let's move along. You have some guests lined up.
We do have guests lined up.
They are waiting.
And they are waiting. And they are in two different places in the country. Guess where we're going? To Portland, Oregon. We've spoken with other women who live and work in Portland, like Ellie Blue and Laura Moulton. And this evening we have a really creative and interesting woman by the name of April Streeter. April literally grew up cycling, spending many days and traveling many miles with her dad. It's no wonder that as an adult, a wife, and a mother, she still thinks so highly of bicycling. She's plunged into publishing and has written the book Women on Wheels. The book is a handbook and how-to for city cyclists, and April has some really good ideas to get more people, and especially more women, riding more often. So we're going to talk to her. We'll also talk with Frosty Wooldridge. What a great name. Seriously, his name is Frosty. He lives in Colorado, but he really lives all over the world, parks it in Colorado when he's not on the road, which is seldom. Frosty is the supreme adventurer. He's traveled hundreds of thousands of miles by bike and has a most unique outlook on how to live your life like an adventure. He has an article in the most recent issue of Bicycle Times, Peace and Harmony While Bicycle Touring with Friends, and talks about how the group riding together creates a unique personality of the ride itself. And his book, How to Live a Life of Adventure, offers detailed steps that will make you want to quit your day job and follow your heart's desires. So let's get to it. Let's welcome April Streeter to The Outspoken Cyclist. April, thanks for joining me this evening.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's been a while. We've been trying to pull this together for a while, so I'm really glad to catch you now that you're back on homeland.
Exactly.
How was your trip?
My trip was great. I was in three cities in Sweden, and so I got to see what cycling is doing there, and I was in Spain where I only went mountain biking, but it was a fantastic trip.
That's great. That's great. So let's talk about your book. That's what we're going to do this evening. Women on Wheels, a handbook and how to for city cyclists. Actually, I think when we talked at one point, you said that a Sirius Press, which is the publishing organization, is you.
It is me. My husband and the designer of the book and myself decided to create a small company to publish the book.
I think it's a great idea. I did the same thing with my book. And it's hard. It's really hard, but you did a really nice job.
Thank you.
You originally said you were going to produce a big, shiny coffee table book, maybe, about cycling, but it ended up being something very, very different. Would you please describe the book and how it went from your original concept to the little pocket size that it is now?
Yes. So I was quite taken with Mikkel Colville-Andersen, and he has a website called Copenhagen Cycle Chic. And that was very much an inspiration for me. So he took a lot of shots on the streets of Copenhagen of women, mostly women, dressed in regular street clothes, riding around. And he took beautiful shots, but just shots of transportational cycling. And I got very interested in that and wanted to replicate that in different cities in the world, not just Copenhagen, but the other cities where women are doing transportational cycling. But as I moved to that project, well, first of all, I'm not a photographer, so that was a bit of a hindrance. And second of all, I mean, my background is with sustainability and sustainable transport, and I realized that what actually is needed is more of a handbook, something that will help to dispel some of the myths about cycling and that will just give some guideposts of how to do it, what to do.
And that is what it does.
Yeah, exactly. And as it transitioned from a kind of coffee table idea, I wanted a format that people would feel comfortable taking with them. For example, if they wanted to go to the bike store and they wanted to have some talking points to use at the bike store, because of course, going into the bike store into what has traditionally been a mostly male environment is one of the things that can stop someone from getting the bike that will really suit them and really suit the biking that they're going to be doing.
You pretty much at the outset say, and I'll quote this, women are the untapped potential, the key resource to put city cycling on par with cars and public transit for our daily transportation. What makes you think so? How do you think that's going to come about?
Well, how it may come about, I think that's still a little bit to be decided. But why I believe that, I think, is because, you know, cities have not yet really done the work to get women on bikes. And there's such a, we have lopsided statistics right now. In fact, when you look at the statistics, if you look at census numbers, women are just barely holding steady. And the growth in cycling that we're mostly seeing is coming from males between the ages of 16 and 64. So that doesn't give the best picture of, you know, women getting out there. But what I believe is that if cities start to do the things that they need to do for women to get on bikes, they will, you know, it's like build it and they will come. And what the effect of that is going to be that we're going to get friendlier city streets. We're going to get city streets that really are complete streets where pedestrians and cyclists and cars are actually sharing the road and sharing the space.
Okay. Do you know Carrie Caffrey?
Sorry?
Do you know someone named Carrie Caffrey?
No, I don't.
She does a program called Cycling Savvy.
Cycling Savvy. Mm-hmm. Sounds fun.
Well, I think you'll like it. I'll let you know about that when we're all done here. So one of the things you think is that women don't ride, and this isn't talked about much, because there's a perceived lack of style. I thought that was an interesting point. What do you mean by that? How do you dispel that thinking?
Well, I think that what I mean by lack of style is that basically for a number of decades, the cycling manufacturers have not really targeted women, and their thinking has been about technology, like advancing the technology of the bike, and also about, from the sport mentality. So bikes are evolving to be driven or to be ridden by people who are interested in sports instead of trying to, though it's happening now, to try and design bikes and gear for bikes for transportational cyclists. So when that happens, style starts to creep in. And by style, I don't mean that you have to look great or fantastic every time you go out on your bike, but we need a broader range of what's considered acceptable and workable when you're riding your bike. You should be able to translate whatever your personal style is now to bike riding without having to, I mean, you might have to make some little shifts for the weather, but you just bring your style onto the bike rather than having to conform to wearing bike kit or dressing in a certain way just because you're riding.
Well, I think that those are all good points. I guess I thought more that you were talking about being able to wear a skirt if you wanted, or wear a different, you know, helmet cover, and actually talking about style in the sense of, you know, chic style, looking good. But I agree that some of the newer bikes maybe are moving in that direction, some of the more urban transportation kind of bikes, don't you think?
Yes, and style is also moving along with that. I mean, in addition to just the bikes themselves, I think the accessories and the gear, you know, there's a whole little, it's a very thin vein, but there's a vein of technical gear that is mostly from very small manufacturers, but that's kind of meeting the need to be practical and yet to also be stylish and to be chic. I guess what I meant was that whatever your style is, I mean, however you dress in your daily life, if you're prone to it, if you love skirts or if you wear heels or if you have mid-sized shoes, you know, like I don't wear high heels, but I do wear some heel, that you can translate that and still make it work on the bike. You don't have to just be wearing, you know, clip-on shoes or bike kit. You can, whatever your style already is, you can kind of shift it to work on the bike if you have the right kind of bike.
Right. Okay. So I think we're on the same page when it comes to style. I think we got that one figured out. So we already sort of discussed the lopsided ratio of women to men. And you do believe that we need to end the male majority in cycling. Do you think it would be okay if we had equality in cycling? Would that be good enough?
Yes, I'd be all for parity. Okay. I mean, I think now we're so lopsided, you know, with some places having only 10 to 25% women in the bike stream and on the lanes. And then we have other cities like Minneapolis where we're getting close to that parity. So I'd be fantastically happy with parity. If we had around 55-45 in either direction, I think that would be great.
And I think that is what a lot of women, I mean, everybody from Girl Bike Love, there's the big Minneapolis thing that's coming up. There's an awful lot of things happening for women.
It's definitely brewing, and things are happening. There's the women's forum that's going to be happening in Long Beach in mid-September. There's lots of stuff, and that's great. But I think that, you know, the enthusiasm there, and that's the first step. And then there's the catch-up that has to happen that's actually on the ground, creating situations where women will actually feel like they want to bike on a daily basis.
Well, let's put your book into play here a little bit. So a woman would pick up your book. Now, reading this, I don't believe it's just for women. I think guys could get a lot out of this book, by the way.
Actually, some of my first readers who were male were like, well, when are you going to write the male's version of the book? And I thought, well, men don't need this. They just kind of get out there and bike. But in some ways, I think that men reading this book develop, or that's what I've heard, the feedback has been that they develop an awareness for the fact that, yes, it's true that there are a lot more men out there. And yes, it's great when there are more women riding, because it makes the bike stream more beautiful, and it makes it more, you know, civilized to a certain degree. So yes, I think there's quite a bit that a man can get out of reading the book.
You take a woman through every possible sort of scenario to get on the bike. So everything from, oh, I'm just deciding I want to ride, and all the way through how to change your own tire and work on your brakes and all kinds of things. How did you sort of come up with the format to move from one thing to another? I mean, even with kids on bikes, these are all the things women are usually afraid to even think about, let alone talk about and read about.
Yeah, I think, I mean, for me, it started with the history. I know that's, I'm going back in history, but for me, it definitely started with a fascination with the history for when women first got on bikes. And so I worked my way from history sort of to present and then to future. So I had a past, present, future idea. And in present, I wanted to talk about all of the things that you need to know to be a transportational cyclist now, and then to end up with a little bit of looking into the future and what things are going to be happening, you know, as we go down the road, like the grand and beautiful vision for the future. So that was kind of how I tried to organize things. But I mean, as a daily blogger for Tree Hugger for over 4 years, I wrote a lot of posts about women in cycling. So I was inspired by some of the work that I'd already done and some of the posts that I'd already written. And I went back to some of the favorites, some of the posts that were very popular. And I used those as a basis for what I thought people wanted to hear and read about.
Well, what's really nice is that each chapter is fairly succinct. They aren't, you know, long and drawn out. It's to the point, read it, get it, do it, you know, and get out there. And as you say, choose a bike for your lifestyle. That's one right there that I thought was really, really good. You know, that a lot of people will go in and they'll say, oh, I like that one. It's purple. Well, maybe it's not going to work for what you want it to work. So you have to be realistic about what you're buying and what you're doing. How do you talk about fear, conquering fear?
Well, I think the main things that I talk about is that, you know, yes, there is going to be some fear there of traffic for some people. And the only way to get around it is to first think that it's something that you want to do. I mean, if you don't want to do it, you can't overcome the fear. But secondarily, to really ride with other people. It doesn't have to be with other women, but I've really noticed in the years that I've been working on the book that you have to be out there with somebody who knows the streets a little bit better than you do. So going on a group ride or finding a like-minded person, if you want to bike commute, if you would like to commute by bike to work on a daily basis, there are services available in some of the major biking cities, San Francisco. I know there's in Portland. I believe there should be something like that in New York, where you can hire someone who will help you figure out your route and then will take you on that route so that you can find the safest route to get from your home to your work and back again.
What a cool idea. So
it's great.
It is a great idea. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, we're speaking with April Streeter. She's written this very nice book, Women on Wheels. It's adorable. It's a handbook and how-to for city cyclists. And it doesn't say for women city cyclists. It is Women on Wheels. But I think everybody could get something out of this book. So really, this is like an interesting entrepreneurial idea, you know, hire me to get you on your route. What a cool idea.
Yeah, it's great. It's part of the renaissance that's happening. I mean, I think that it's responding to a little bit of a need, because if you want to be a commuter and if you're going to do that on a daily basis, you definitely want the safest route. You want the route that's going to work. And so having somebody who knows the streets better figure it out for you is fabulous.
Yeah, why not? And plus you'll have the added sort of safety net of having somebody go with you a few times maybe on your route to help you.
Exactly. And yeah. I think that's one thing that's very pertinent for right now. So we're at the end of the summer, and this is a fantastic time to start riding if you want to ride to work, because we've got good weather. So if you can try your route that you come up with or try some little alternate routes while the weather is good, you'll be well set up for when the weather starts to turn into fall and winter to keep doing it. So this is a great time to start.
I actually want to kind of skip to the last chapter where you talk about everything old is new, and it's about bicycle weddings.
Yes.
And so I've heard of a few over the years, but you seem to think it's a trend.
Yes. And I think, well, first of all, I mean, maybe it's partially because I'm living in Portland, which is Bike City, USA.
That's true.
We go back and forth with Minneapolis, but we love to have the crown. So, and I've seen so many bike weddings that have happened in Portland. But I believe that once you're featured in a Martha Stewart magazine, which bicycle weddings have been, you're a trend, whatever you are, person, place, or thing. If you're in Martha Stewart, you're a trend. So that's my rationale for believing that bike weddings are a trend. But another trend that I don't talk about is moving by bike. That's happening in cities such as Portland. And I haven't heard about it in New York, but I have heard about it in San Francisco, where you actually move from your apartment or your house to your new abode specifically by bike.
So I have a story for you about that, a very quick one. We have a really good friend who went to school in Colorado. She and her husband now live up in Oswego, New York. I know they listen to the show, so she's going to like this. She did do that. And this was probably, oh my goodness, it has to be probably 20 years ago. And the part I remember is that she somehow strapped that vacuum cleaner onto the back of her bike and moved it from her old apartment to her new apartment. And she did, in fact, move by bike. And this was a long time ago.
She was a trendsetter,
exactly.
But far before her time.
Exactly. She also rides a fixie. So she's a special girl.
She is. She definitely is.
Yeah. So the last thing I really want to talk about is more opinion. You live in a place, as you said, Portland, that is so bike friendly and is so well known for being bike friendly. How do you think cities and towns can get the kinds of changes that Portland and Minneapolis are enjoying? I mean, what are the things that are going to have to be done? And I believe women are going to drive some of this, this change.
I think there's a couple of things. So I'm going to talk about two. I think the first one is that any city can have a cyclovia type event. Like we call ours in Portland, Sunday Parkways. And that's a day when just a portion of the town, they close off the streets to car traffic and bikes and skateboards and pedestrians and people on tricycles and people riding or walking in whatever format have the streets to themselves. A city can do that with very little money and very little preparation. I mean, it takes some, but that kind of event brings out everybody to enjoy the streets. And that's one way you can start if you don't have a bicycle culture. That can begin to develop the bicycle culture. So that's the easy, fun side. But then the more difficult side is people just really need to get on the streets and ride. And once they do that, there's certain parts of every town that will work for riding, it's going to spur the local governments to do the heavy lifting that's required to get bike lanes. I mean, Portland's not perfect. I just want to say we don't have separated bike lanes like they do in Copenhagen and Amsterdam and even in Stockholm, where you're separated from the traffic by a curb or some other, you're raised away from the traffic. Those are the kinds of lanes that women love to ride in, and we don't have very much of that in Portland. We don't have the money for that, but we do have somewhat of a middle ground, and we have these neighborhood greenways where we share the road with the cars and with the pedestrians, but we've got little chevrons, little guide markers on the road that show that this is going to be a reduced speed street and this is going to be a street where cyclists are welcome to be on the road.
And how is the reception to the reduced speed? Not so much the cyclists being on the road, but I think what drivers tend to dislike most is being impeded from where they want to go at the speed they want to go.
Yes. And there does, you know, we go through stages where that drivers will get a little bit more upset about that. And then they'll realize that, you know, the cyclists are here to stay. And I want to mention one thing that is from the book, and that's the Mary Poppins effect. And it has been shown somewhat anecdotally, but I hope they do more studies on this, that when people are dressed stylishly, that car drivers tend to slow down for them. And the effect has been noticed mostly in women. So women who are wearing stylish outfits, cars tend to go slower and to be more careful around them. So I think that's it. That's both a, you know, it's like an incentive for people to get out there because cars eventually learn how to share the road. And it's also incentive to dress stylishly while they do so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, I think that then it's time to tell our listeners how they can get a copy of your book.
Great. Well, it's available in a very limited degree to some bookstores in Portland, but the easiest way is online at A Serious Press, one word, aseriouspress.com. So there it should just be a few clicks to be able to order the book online, and I'm the shipping and distribution department, so when you make that order, I get your book out the very next day.
Well, April, welcome back to the States again. Thank you so much for joining me on the show this evening. Lots of luck with many, many sales on your book. And I don't know, are you going to any of the shows, NABS or Interbike or any place?
I'll be going to Interbike, so you'll see me not with a booth, but I'll be going around with my little cigar box and at least giving out some postcards and some stickers to let you know about the book. So, yes, I definitely will be there.
Well, I'll see you there.
Okay, that's great, Diane. Thanks so much for having me.
And have a great night.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
April Streeter joined us from Portland, Oregon.
Yes, she did. Doing a lot of stuff, evidently. She writes for treehugger.com.
Okay.
And she is a mom. She's got two kids. Gets to go to Sweden every summer.
Yeah, and she's published a great book.
I do like the book. I think it's really, really a good idea. I think the graphics are nice. Everything about it, it's kind of just like, you know, hold it in your little hands.
Yeah, very cool.
I like it.
Let's take a short break,
okay, shall
we? And when we come back, we're going adventuring.
We're going to Colorado, Golden, Colorado, and we're going to talk with Frosty Wooldridge, Mr. Adventurer.
Okay.
All right.
Stay tuned for that right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
The Artists' Archives of the Western Reserve is pleased to present Craft Exhibition, a gallery display of metal, jewelry, pottery, ceramics, fabric, glass, wood, and functional paper art by 17 local artists. This free show opens with a reception on August 3rd and runs through August 30th at the AAWR Gallery, located at 1834 East 123rd Street in University Circle. Gallery hours and more information at artistsarchives.org.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
And we are back. At least one of us is back. I don't know about the other. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist, and we're going to go straight away out to Colorado and talk with a very interesting gentleman.
Hey, I'm back.
Okay.
I'm back, and I'm going to talk to him.
All right.
Frosty.
Get going.
Wooldridge,
then.
Thanks for joining us on The Outspoken Cyclist this evening.
Well, thank you, Diane. It's just a pleasure to be with you this evening, and I'm excited to just share with all cyclists across the country about one of my favorite pastimes, and that's either riding a bike in town or in the mountains or certainly on tour. That's what we're all in love with, and that's the bicycling.
Well, it's not just around the country. It's around the world. In fact, we have a bunch of new listeners from Malaysia this week and from Sweden this week. So lots of people are going to hear what you have to say. So let's get the obvious out of the way. Frosty is not your given name. What is your given name that you don't use?
My given name is Forrest with two R's, Forrest
okay.
Howard Wooldridge. And by the time I was 12 years old, I just kind of took on to a sports nickname called Frosty. And my brother started calling me that, and that's what I liked more than Forrest. And so the only person who calls me Forrest is my mother.
Of course she does. Of course she does. Where did you grow up?
I'm a service brat. My father was in the United States Marine Corps for 27 years.
Wow.
So by the time I was 18, I had lived all over the United States from the East Coast to the West Coast and out of country, lived in Hawaii for several years. And since that time, I've traveled well over 125,000 miles on my bicycle across six continents. This summer was the eighth time across the United States of America, coast to coast. and I've traveled on a bicycle from the Arctic all the way to Antarctica, and yes, I have bicycled and camped out in Antarctica.
Somebody else wasn't that a couple weeks ago we talked to somebody who met his wife in Antarctica? Yes, we did. In fact, it was Don Ferris from Anvil Bike Works. But anyway, so how did you get into cycling and then have it expand into this amazing lifetime pursuit?
The thing that was so great for me, and I'm thankful for it, is that my parents were somewhat modest in income. And so we always camped out. And I, as a child, needed to make money just to have some spending money. And so from the age of 11, I always had a paper out. And as you can imagine, that's the morning news, and I would ride my bicycle with the steel racks on the front, steel racks on the back, and then two side bags on both sides of me, and I threw papers as a paper boy from age 11 to 18.
Wow.
And then from that, of course, I got to see many, many sunrises and the animals in the woods and just the quiet of the cycling and the pedaling and the people. And then from there, 6 years in college, I always rode my bicycle to classes. And I became a math and science teacher after that. And at that point, I had a friend in Boulder, Colorado, and we had 24 miles to get to our school where we taught. Ward Olin was his name, in fact. And so every morning in the fall and the spring, we rode 24 miles to work and 24 miles back, and it was incredible. And then Ward introduced me to bicycle touring, with panniers on the bike and the racks and all that goes with it. I, of course, had 3 months off every summer, and within a week of my first bicycle across America, I was totally hook, line, and sinker, addicted to bicycle touring, and it has been a lifelong passion.
What made you leave the classroom in the traditional sense? Because obviously now you teach about living your life as an adventure, which is a very cool thing. I think it's awesome. But what was the impetus for you to change from a conventional life to a life of adventure that suddenly you just said, okay, I'm out of the classroom? How did you do that?
Well, it was a long journey, and it's sometimes not always so pleasant, because you always have to have money, and you have to have a purpose, and you have to have passion. And one of the things that happened to me along the way was I found that I could write really well, and I started writing articles for magazines, and these were adventure articles. And the reason I'd read a couple of like Outside Magazine, and then there were different bike magazines, and there was Outdoor Magazines. And these, I said, my gosh, I can write better than that, and I can take better pictures. So what I did on my journeys was start taking pictures, and I started writing stories, and then I started writing books. And after a while, I was able to utilize those talents and then make the transfer from the classroom right into the writing realm. But I also always have had a second job, and that's part of the process, and that's how I got to go around the world.
What's your second job?
Well, I've been a bartender.
Oh, cool.
I've been a dance teacher. I have been a truck driver. I've been a heavy equipment. I've been a lifeguard. I have been involved in organizing trash pickups. I've been a short order cook. I've been a dishwasher.
A Renaissance man. You've done it all.
I really had a lot. I was a cardiac catheterization technician. I was a U.S. Army second lieutenant, Medical Service Corps. And so I was a mover for furniture. I've been a asphalt hauler for
You can't
a big
be that old, Frosty. I mean, how many? Never mind. We won't go there. Let's talk about your book.
Okay.
So your book is titled How to Live a Life of Adventure, The Art of Exploring the World. And I want to know some of not only how to do that, but some of the adventures you have experienced, too.
Well, I'm very thrilled and excited. What happened was 2 years ago. Someone said, Frosty, you have lived such a fantastic life of adventure. And in fact, In 2010, I completed another coast-to-coast across America, and that was my third, and this summer was my fourth, and then I've gone four borders to border from Canada to Mexico. So I've had eight trips across America. And along the way, I've always written stories, amazing stories, stories that you would never, couldn't possibly have lived unless you were on a bicycle touring at 12 miles an hour through the wilderness and the people that you meet. And I said, I'll write a book about it. So it took me 2 years, and I didn't quite know what the title would be, but of course the obvious title is How to Live a Life of Adventure, and then I put a subtitle on it, The Art of Exploring the World. And then several friends said, well, why don't you do this, go give a presentation to REI. That's the sports equipment store across the country. They also, a couple of high schools were interested, and civic clubs, even a church group was interested. And here in Denver, Colorado, and I live in Golden, Colorado at 8,000 feet. I said, yeah, okay. So I put it all together as a classroom teacher. I used all my training and I put together this presentation, and I actually have a DVD of it. And I thought maybe 15, 20 people would come to the presentation. Well, the presentation was packed, standing room only, 300 people. They had to bring in extra chairs.
And be careful what you wish for.
Be careful what you wish for. And then I put a slideshow onto the program. And so anyway, what I did was put this book together so that anyone at any age, and you can read this book if you're 13 or 14 or 15 years old, you can read it if you're 91, 92, or 93 years old, and it will show you how to completely change your life over into what you'd like to do, what you want to do, with the purpose and the passion and the creativity that can transform your life, because it's transformed mine. I mean, all the jobs that I've worked over the years have been a part of my adventure. They also funded the adventures that I have been enjoying. And of course, I have a bucket list that I continue to work on, and actually it grows. And like next summer, I'm going to bicycle the entire profile of the Boot of Italy. I'm Io capisco un po' l'italiano, e lei?
No, not me. But so I guess that comes under the head. It all comes under the heading of, if you want to do something, ask somebody who's busy. So you just have plenty to do and always more to do, and it's always an adventure. Let me take a moment to remind our listeners, though, we're talking with Frosty Wooldridge about his new book, How to Live a Life of Adventure, The Art of Exploring the World, and he does most of it with a bicycle. So define living a life of adventure.
Well, that's, I think, an important part of every human being's journey. And so I defined adventure, in fact, and I want everyone to know that I celebrate all forms of adventure. You may be a macrame artist. You may be an artist painting pictures. You may do landscapes. You may be a photographer. You may love dance. You may want to be a parent and bring up children in the world. And I celebrate all of those. In fact, I had one artist who had bought the book, emailed me to my website, howtolivealifeofadventure.com, and said, I want to thank you, Mr. Wooldridge, for really honoring everyone's adventure pursuits, because I'm an artist. You may be a golfer and you want to have adventure of golfing, or you may want to be a river raft captain, or you may want to be a cyclist, or even a ski bum.
All of that makes perfect sense to me. What happens when you come across somebody who is so not a risk taker? Because there's an element of risk, of jumping off that cliff, of doing something that maybe you thought you wouldn't do. Now, I'm a risk taker, and I will do those kinds of things, but I know a lot of fairly timid people. How do you talk to them about this and get these concepts and practices across to them?
That's the key, and I really deal with that, because I know when I first started as an adventurer myself, the insecurity factor or the fear factor or I haven't done that factor, I'm not sure of myself factor, all of those come into play. And I was just like anybody else. And I've been told many times, Frosty, you're going to get killed if you go off to such and such an adventure. You could die on the journey and all that goes with that. Are you sure you know what you're doing? And so in the book, I actually show anyone at whatever level of sense of or fear or insecurity or unsuredness how to overcome those fears and how others have. And I really address this with women and with men, and I use a lot of some of the great adventurers out there that were unsure of themselves also. And what I do in the book is intersperse. Each chapter has a quote from a woman or a man, like Amelia Earhart or even Susan B. Anthony, or certainly Eleanor Roosevelt, Jane Goodall, others like Charles Lindbergh. You can go on and on and on, but I also have quotes from much quieter adventurers. And the goal or the key for anyone who wants to live a life of adventure is start out with baby steps. If you want to go out camping, do you go out on a week-long backpack trip into the Rocky Mountains? No. What you do is you join a club. And I've got several different websites. I've got dozens of websites where you can meet up with people who are a little bit maybe afraid or insecure or unsure. They then get with persons who know what they're doing. It's called meetup.com is one of the great websites across this country. There's also tut.com with Mike Dooley. And also you can read books, not just mine. I have literally about 20 books by men and women in my book that might chime in with a reader a little bit better than my writing, and so encourage them in the same way. But most of these writers always say, start out small, start out easy, start out with somebody who knows what they're doing, and that way you'll gain confidence by a little overnight backpack trip, or an overnight bicycle journey, or an overnight raft trip, or an overnight whatever it is that you, and it even shows you how to find your passions in this book. So it all means that you have to start out with baby steps, and once you get the little baby steps, you then gain the confidence to take bigger steps. And that's what happened to me. My first tour was just a little small tour. Found out that I loved it. I bicycled for almost 2 weeks around Lake Superior with my friend. And wow, this was pretty exciting. And then after that, I got with more other touring people. And you find them. In fact, anyone who wants to get really into bicycle touring, you can go to adventurecycling.com or .org, excuse me. There's also bicycling, it's called Bicycle Times, and that has incredible information for those of you who want it. There's also Tandem, which is for tandem riders. And I have all these in the book, so you can find your way slowly, surely, and confidently, and then move toward your adventures.
Let's talk a second about the article in Bicycle Times. You and I were both in that particular issue. That's issue number 18. And you wrote an article called Peace and Harmony While Bicycle Touring with Friends. And you came up with a pretty interesting concept, one that I had never even thought about. And that is that riding with a group of people, the ride itself, just the entity that becomes the ride, takes on a personality. What an interesting idea. Explain that.
Well, you know, we all have personalities.
Yeah.
We all have bias. We all have insecurities. We all have strong points. We all are of different ways of life. We come with baggage. Some of us are extroverts. Some of us are introverts. Some of us are very talkative. Some of us are very quiet. And I love John Steinbeck, who wrote the book Travels with Charlie back in 1950 or so. He was with his dog, and he traveled around the United States to get a piece of life on the road. And let me just quote what he says. Once a journey is designed, equipped, and put in process, a new factor enters and takes over. A trip, a safari, or an exploration is an entity different from all other journeys. It has a personality, temperament, and individuality and uniqueness. A journey is a person in itself. No two are alike, and all plans, safeguards, policing, and coercion are fruitless. We find after years of struggle that we do not take a trip takes us. Tour masters, schedules, reservations, brass bound and inevitable, dashed themselves to wreckage on the personality of the trip. In this, a journey is like a marriage. The certain way to be wrong is to think you can control it. I feel better now having said this, although only those who have experienced it will understand it. Unquote. That's John Steinbeck.
Yeah.
And a lot of you who have been on trips or journeys or even weekend vacation, I'm sure you have had personality disputes with other individuals on the trip. You may have all sorts of different kinds of conflicts. And what I tried to do in this piece, it's in Bicycle Times in the August and September issue, is Peace and Harmony While Bicycle Touring with Friends. But you can also use it for rafting or skiing or backpacking or any kind of journey that you have more than one person, and find the ways to enjoy peace and harmony so that instead of you can't wait for the journey to be over, you hope that it goes on forever because you've learned how to get along with and respect all of your fellow adventurers, and the journey is one of bliss, of joy, exploration, and personal fulfillment. So, yeah, it's going to be a good piece, I think, and a lot of people already have been responding to it.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah, it just is an interesting concept, and one that, you know, if you've ever been on an organized tour or a big tour, you find out, you know, that all these little cliques get set up. It's kind of an interesting dynamic, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. So can you give us a couple of examples of adventures that just blew you away? I mean, you've done so many, but can you pick out a couple that really, really you just need to talk about it?
Well, thank you, Diane. Back in 1984, I cycled across America by myself because I couldn't find anybody to go with me because they all thought, you're crazy. We don't want to do that. How could anybody be so crazy as to bicycle 3,500 miles across America? And so I said, heck, I'm going. And so I did, from Manhattan Beach in Los Angeles all the way to Jekyll Island, Georgia. And I was on, I think it was Route 380 south of Socorro, New Mexico, riding through these unbelievable mountains and these great valleys and the heat and the dry and the just the serendipity. And up ahead of me on the road, I saw in front of me about 50 yards away, it was a tall man and what looked like he had a dog walking alongside of him. And I kept coming up and I said, oh my gosh. I got closer, you know, it's 40 yards, 30 yards. That's not a dog. That's a man. And the man is walking on his hands. And this was on the left-hand side of the highway. And then the man that was tall man was walking, actually was reading a book. And up ahead, about 100 yards ahead of that, was a small van, a pickup truck with a camper. And I kept coming closer, and my gosh, it was a man walking on his hands, and the reason he was walking on his hands is because he didn't have any legs. His legs were completely severed at the groin. And I kept coming closer, and I can't believe my eyes. And finally, as I got right next to him, hey, good morning, how you doing? And I threw my bike onto the gravel there and walked across the highway. And this man, he was walking on his hands. He had two tire treads with a bar across them, some gloves on. Those were his pads for his hands. He lowered himself to the ground, and he was a Vietnam War veteran. And anyway, I said, hey, Frosty Wooldridge, how you doing? He looks up at me, and he shakes my hand, and the other fellow's name, I forget, was Arnie, I think. And I said, what are you doing out here? And he said, well, I could ask you the same thing. I said, well, I'm bicycling across America, coast to coast. And he says, and I'd like to bicycle across America too, but my legs are too short. You know, I didn't know exactly what to say, but I said, well, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. And anyway, we start talking for another, you know, 20 minutes or so, and he had walked from the West Coast there, 936 miles in 19 months, and that he said I could live in a VA hospital for the rest of my life, and you know, drink beer and chew on potato chips and eat pizzas all the time and do nothing, or I can go out and do something with my life with what I have left. And in that conversation, I was beyond inspired. Here is a man with an extraordinary handicap that decided to live life to the max. And you can all look up Bob Wieland, and look him up on the internet. He's one of the top 20 stories in the last 100 years of America. He not only had walked across America, and in fact, 2 years later, I did another bicycle trip across America with two Australians. And on the last day of the ride, Bob Whelan actually touched down on the East Coast. I think it was Virginia Beach, Virginia. And he had walked across America on his hands in 3 years, 8 months, and 6 days. I think that's the number. I started crying immediately. Even the day that I walked across, back across the road and got on my bike, I started crying like a baby. I was thrilled. I was inspired. I was in pain for this man who was, lost his legs in Vietnam. And yet to this day, I'm inspired. And that story is like the lead-off story in the book. And anyone who thinks that they have handicaps, anyone who thinks that they are diminished or can't do something, let me tell you, years later, Bob Whelan actually hand-cycled across America, not just once, but twice, both ways. He has the world bench press record. He has run in the Ironman triathlon and come in and finished 5 days later, of course. He has run in marathons. I mean, he's done so many amazing things with his life. And people always ask me, why do I have such a good, you know, attitude, and why am I so enthusiastic? And I say, because I've met Bob Whelan. Well, you're going to meet him in the book, and he will inspire you.
So where could people get a copy of your book, Frosty?
Oh, my gosh. You know, it's on Kindle. I have a DVD of the program that I've done in front of REI audiences, which is a live program. And that is on my website at howtolivealifeofadventure.com. You can also get it at Amazon. So you can get the book's on Amazon. It's on Kindle. It's up my website.
Well, I really appreciate you telling us about your book and about your adventures and about just the excitement and enthusiasm that you have for living your life fully. I think it's, you know, we only get usually one shot unless you believe other things. But exploring the world is something that I think everybody needs to do in his or her own way. And obviously, you're giving them some tools to do that. So we will put a link to your site and to the book on our Outspoken Cyclist Facebook page. We will also reference it on WJCU.org. And I hope to run into you again sometime soon.
Thank you, Diane.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Frosty Woolridge joined us from Golden, Colorado.
He did indeed.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that's his home necessarily, but he's there
sometimes.
I think
his home's on the seat of a bike, sounds like.
He's a force of nature.
Yes, he is. Tell you what,
Wow. Inspirational
when it comes to riding a bike and doing what you want to do, having an adventure. He's Mr. Adventure.
Yeah. Well, we'll live for another week.
Let's hope so.
And come back at you with another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist then.
And we have a really cool guest next week.
Okay. You want to tell us about it?
I do.
Okay.
And anybody who knows anything about mountain biking, free riding, downhilling, extreme, will know the name Hans Rey.
Oh, yeah.
And Hans Rey will be with us on The Outspoken Cyclist next week.
All right. Until then, ride safely.
And don't forget to go to our Facebook page to check all these links.
That's right.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.